Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law and Religious Liberties Practice Groups, was recorded on Wednesday, August 16, 2017, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's teleforum conference call. This afternoon, we will be discussing Ronald Richlack's latest book, The Persecution and Genocide of Christians in the Middle East, Prevention, Prohibition, and Prosecution. My name is Wesley Hodges, and I am the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today we are happy to have with us Professor Ronald J. Richlack, co-editor and contributor to this book, and the Jamie L. Whitten Chair of Law and Government, Professor of Law at the University of Mississippi School of Law. Also with us is Nina Shea, an international human rights lawyer for over 30 years, former commissioner on the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, and current director of the Center for Religious Freedom at the Hudson Institute. She is also a contributor to this book. We will begin with a moderated discussion between Ron and Nina, and then halfway through, we will move to an audience Q&A. Thank you both for speaking with us. Nina, the first question is for you. So the Secretary of State has now said that ISIS is committing genocide in the Middle East. Would you please comment on what is actually happening? What is the significance of this statement?
Yes, you're absolutely right, Wesley, and it's great to be with you. Secretary Tillerson just yesterday, while everyone had bated breath, came out and pronounced that what ISIS has done to the Christians and other minorities in northern Iraq as genocide, as religious genocide. So it's the Christians, he included the Christians, the Yazidis, and the Shia. And indeed, this is a genocide. Under ISIS, it's not well known, it's not well understood, but there was not a single Christian community that was left intact, either in Iraq or in Syria. That is in the territory that they controlled. And this means that there were no priests or clergy left, no pastors. They were either killed or abducted or driven out, and that all the churches were closed and many of them were destroyed. And including ancient monasteries that were 1400 or 1500 years old. There's a satellite picture of one that was just pulverized into white dust in northern Iraq by ISIS. And then the people, they were terrorized and driven off. Of course, you have seen the images probably of the N, standing for Nazarene, the Arabic letter N, stamped on their homes in red right before, as a prelude to this. This terror strike against northern Nineveh. And this happened in 2014, in the summer of 2014, over several weeks, including this week, 3 years ago. And it was a storming through with the intent of creating a caliphate, which was then announced from Mosul, which is the capital of Nineveh province, where these Christians and other groups were. And in the book, we look at Christians. We're coming at it with a legal perspective. I'm coming at it with a human rights lens, but the authors happen to be Christian, and we are taking into account pronouncements by the Vatican and by church teaching. So it's really should be seen as a case study of what happened to the other minorities as well, to some extent. And certainly the international law is a case study of what might be possible solutions for the other groups. What is important to remember is that the Christians of Iraq had been terrorized and victimized by extremists for a decade before ISIS showed up, so that they had fled southern cities like Basra and Baghdad for the most part and were living in this Nineveh area. So when ISIS stormed through, it wanted to purify its caliphate by eradicating every non-Muslim group in there, and including Shia Muslims, whom they considered heretics. And ISIS's perspective sees Christians as polytheists, as infidels. They call them polytheists because of their belief in the doctrine of the Trinity, and idolaters. So that's what they call Christians. They do not see them as people of the book, which is a traditional Muslim formulation for Christians and Jews and Zoroastrians who lived under Islamic rule during the historical caliphates of the last millennia. And that, by the way, is that history is also treated in this book, which is fascinating. So ISIS does not see Christians as people of the book, which means that they do not see a way of peaceful coexistence with them. And they do not give them an option to pay a jizya or a poll tax. That has been broadly misunderstood. That has been, in fact, ISIS propaganda put forward to make itself appear more caliph-like, more acceptable to Muslims, that it is has given Christians an option to pay a tax and to live peacefully as Christians under their rule. This did not happen. ISIS, for the Christians that remained under ISIS, they were almost to a one, really, forcibly converted to Islam. And they had no way of practicing their faith whatsoever. The churches were closed. They had to, whatever prayers they said were in the secret confines of their home in their hearts. So they did not congregate, and there were basically very few left. They were mostly elderly and disabled because they had already had some encounters with ISIS, both with their predecessor groups in the preceding years, because they evolved out of IC, that is, Islamic State of Iraq, and before that, Al-Qaeda in Iraq. So there had been an evolution into ISIS, and they had suffered terribly. There had been a terrible scourge of hostage-taking and ransom and rape and blowing up churches. Starting in 2004, there was a coordinated bombing of six churches in Baghdad. So this had been going on for a decade. They knew that they saw the writing on the wall, and most of them fled into refugee camps. Now they went, those who remained behind, some of the women and girls were taken as slaves, including a 13-year-old girl, Christina. And actually, Christina has just resurfaced, age 6 years old now, doesn't speak any of her native language of Assyrian, which is the Aramaic, which is the language that Jesus of Nazareth spoke, which these people speak, these Christians. She had been last heard, she was snatched from her mother's lap in Karakosh, which is the largest city on the Nineveh Plain. She had been last heard from when another Christian woman called on her cell phone to her family, saying that she was caring for Christina in a holding pen where both of them were about to later that day be sold on a slave market in Mosul. So we don't know quite what happened to her. She was found wandering alone after the liberation of Mosul just in recent months, this summer, age six now. The other women were taken and have reemerged in the last couple months as well, liberated as well from Nineveh and Mosul. And one woman, who's a middle-aged woman, had been sold to 10 men as a slave over the last 3 years, horribly traumatized. Another woman told Cardinal McCarrick, who interviewed her, and I interviewed him, that she saw her husband crucified to the front door of their home by ISIS. So these kinds of incidents are being documented. It's not systematic, that we're just beginning to learn what has happened. There was this propaganda, as I said, that ISIS allowed Christians to pay a jizya and they could peacefully coexist with them. Unfortunately, that has been picked up and repeated by, among others, other very influential voices. The UN established Syrian Independent Commission of Inquiry on Syria. They published a report on the Yazidis, and one conclusory paragraph determined or concluded that Christians were able to live peacefully under ISIS and pay a jizya tax. And that has lived on in the media and has been picked up by the British Parliament, Library of Congress, the equivalent of the library, well, the equivalent of the Congressional Research Commission. So it has caused a lot of disinformation or damage to the cause and the public understanding of really what ISIS wanted to do here and what its objectives were, and also the policies that needed to flow from any kind of determination of genocide. You know, maybe I can stop there and we can talk about that later.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Nina, for addressing the severity of the situation. Ron, now we turn to you as co-editor of the book. Would you mind taking a few moments and explaining the purpose for it and the structure of the book for just the audience's benefit?
All right, well, thank you, Wesley, and Nina does such a great job here on the radio, but also in her chapter, laying out these problems, these horrific matters. Truly, I mean, there are chapters in this book that are difficult to read, but very important to read. And having Nina, Bob Destro, Kevin Govern, Jane Adolph, so many people who have taken time to lay out the problems and to look for the possibility of legal solutions. You know, what can we do? Many of us contribute to the book are involved in law or international matters in one way or another. Are there different things that we can do to try to bring about changes to correct some of these horrible things that are happening? And one of the big ones, of course, we mentioned was getting a declaration that a genocide is in fact occurring, and we got that from Pope Francis, I think, first, or one of the early ones anyway, and then just quite recently, yesterday, I guess, the Secretary of State Tillerson for the United States. But we're still looking for it at the United Nations, and we're looking for it from other groups, because that invokes certain legal remedies, assistance that can be given to the victims, and the ability to prosecute people who are perpetrating the crime of genocide. The chapter I wrote in the book happens to be about the International Criminal Court, and the crime of genocide is one of those crimes that the court has jurisdiction over. Unfortunately, there in law, there are two things. There's having jurisdiction over the crime, and there's having jurisdiction over the people. And the way the court is structured right now, it really doesn't have jurisdiction over the people. That's a second problem I talk about in my chapter. So the International Criminal Court, which has great promise, really has not been particularly effective in dealing with matters like this. But we don't limit the book to looking at the International Criminal Court. We've got chapters on domestic law, international law. Kevin Seepley, the dean at Ave Maria Law School, has a long chapter on international criminal law and how that might be applied in certain cases. Mark Bonner, also at Ave Maria, has a chapter on using the Torture Act under United States law. Is there, you know, does this constitute torture, and does that open up the ability to prosecute people? All of these sort of, however, require a police action, a military. You got to capture the bad guys before you can try them and punish them. So that problem does permeate as we go through. But, you know, understanding the problem, lining up legal responses and the ability to deal with it legally as it comes along, looking at diplomacy along the way. John Czarnecki has a great chapter on the Holy See's diplomacy in this matter. And we've have international humanitarian law, a chapter on that, Kevin Govern. So many people looking at different ways, different possible solutions, and nudging the international community, the national communities, to begin looking for solutions, document the problem, look for solutions. And I think this book, and you know, when you edit a book instead of writing it, I think you can brag a little bit more on it. I'm so proud of this book, and it's not because of my chapter, it's because of Nina's chapter and Bob Destro's chapter and Robert Festighi, who talks about the historical and theological background of persecution of Christians. I doubt if there are a handful of people in the world who would read this book without coming away having learned a whole lot about what's going on, about what historically went on, and what the future holds as a possible remedy for the horrors that are taking place.
Thank you, Ron. Just to dive deeper on one subject you brought up, you said your chapter was on the ICC, correct?
That's right.
Would you mind, for the audience, diving a little deeper and explaining what are some of the criticisms of that?
Well, sure. The International Criminal Court grows from the Rome Statute when, in 1998, nations of the world gathered in Rome and hammered out a treaty. It's called the Statute of the International Criminal Court. But then I believe it was 2003, 2004 perhaps, I think 2003, that the 60th ratification of the statute was submitted at the United Nations and the court came into being. And it's a court that's designed to prosecute the worst violators of crimes against humanity, genocide, war crimes, and the crime of aggression, which is essentially waging an unjust war. It grows out of, essentially, if you want to think of Nuremberg, you know, when you've got people who've committed these horrific, horrific crimes against the world, we need some place to try them. We should have some laws in place so they can't, you know, claim that we didn't violate the law. As the some German arguments were, what we did was not against the law. This is victor's justice. This is ex post facto. In other words, you're punishing us for a crime that wasn't a crime when we did it. The court's designed to kind of put those pieces in place and to have something ready to be able to invoke against people who commit these really, really horrible crimes. The problem with the court that I find, one of the things I write about in the book, is that it grows out of World War II. World War II, as you recall, ended with a demand for unconditional surrender, and it meant that essentially, he told the Nazis, fight until the bitter end, send the old folks and the kids out to fight because there will be no negotiation. Everyone will face justice ultimately. And that does create a problem when you have, let's say, Gaddafi in Libya, who might have been able to seek, you know, sanctuary in some neutral country, and the reign of terror might have ended. It happened actually in Chile with Pinochet, where he stepped down, and in exchange for an amnesty or an immunity, you end the reign of terror. And then Pinochet's fell apart later on. But you know, there are abilities to negotiate and to bring things to an end. I think the Lord's Resistance Army, I've written about that, how that there was a chance maybe to bring that to resolution there, but the International Criminal Court, by demanding prosecution in every case, actually can stand in the way. So the court, well intended, and I think fundamentally brings some important pieces of justice to the table, also creates some problems that are maybe inherent in having a new structure like this. And ultimately, frankly, in this case, and in so many cases, one of the big problems is it simply doesn't have a police force. So people aren't coming to the court until they're brought to the court, and you need somebody to bring people to the court.
Thank you, Ron. Just to follow up on the lack of police force, has the ICC had any success in prosecuting anyone to do with the current genocide being committed by ISIS?
Nothing with the genocide. There have been, I believe, three trials to conclusion before the court, and this is a court that's been in existence now for 15 years or so, maybe 14. But the court relies upon national police forces to bring people into justice, to come and face trial. Well, a lot of times, you know, the leadership is not subject to being arrested because they control all of the force. And that's, again, another problem with the court. Hopefully these things will be worked out, but as it stands right now, the court promises a lot, and but has not been very effective in terms of being able to bring about any sort of peace.
Thank you, Ron. Referring back to a point, Nina, that you brought up earlier, how do you find that sexual violence? What does that have to do with the religious persecution going on?
Well, it's very much a part of it. I mean, the women under ISIS were targeted for not only rapes that you find in the battlefield, unfortunately, in many conflicts, but for enslavement and forced marriage, which is entails trafficking, it entails torture, it entails forced conversion. And we saw that particularly strikingly in the Yazidi example, where there's estimates of up to 5,000 women and girls taken, and a couple thousand of them have been released or freed since then, escaped. And then in the Christian case in by ISIS, there were Christians and girls that were also taken that they could capture. And so it was a serial rape and long-term captivity and conversion. And then ISIS also in its documents, in its propaganda magazines, praised Boko Haram in Nigeria for their large-scale abduction of schoolgirls, Chibok schoolgirls from the town of Chibok in northern Nigeria, and taking them as, quote, jihadi brides or wives. In fact, this was enslavement, permanent sexual enslavement, when they were forced pregnancies and conversions there as well. All of them were forcibly converted. About 100 of those girls have resurfaced, have been captured or escaped, but 200 remain to this day enslaved, as do thousands of Yazidis in Iraq and Syria, and some Christians, about 50 or so Christians, women and girls. So this is part of the genocide. It's an element of genocide, of the crime. It's evidence of genocide. And, you know, we took a solemn vow about 70 years ago after the Jewish Holocaust that never again would we remain silent in the face of genocide and do nothing. And I have to say that looking at the international law aspect of it, reading Ron's chapter, it's been an abysmal failure. It has neither prevented the genocide, nor did it, protect. Has it resulted in the protection of these people? And in the case of, and there's other ways of dealing with genocide other than the legal response. There is the political response, which I think has also been a failure. And then there's the policy response, which we're pinning some hope on with the secretary's designation. The Secretary of State Tillerson embraced as a State Department finding, and this is more of an executive finding of genocide in his statements yesterday. And it was a similar statement had been uttered by Secretary Kerry in 2016. That there was genocide against these three groups of Christians, Yazidis, and Shia, but he made it sound like it was his personal judgment, and it was he said it in his opinion or his views, and that's what Secretary Kerry did last year, and that has been seized by the press and by others in the bureaucracy who didn't want to deal with this issue as being, well, that's just his personal view. In fact, when the State Department published the annual report on human rights in March, in early March, under the chapter of Iraq, it omitted the Secretary's own finding, the Secretary of the State Department finding that this was genocide, the most egregious crime known to humanity was, that finding was made in 2016. This report on Iraq, produced by the same department for 2016, covering the year 2016, omitted this finding, didn't mention it. And after some political pressure build, at the end of March, the State Department issued an errata sheet saying that, oh, well, we forgot. Whoops, we forgot that we meant to put in that there was a finding of genocide in the Iraq chapter. So we're pinning our hopes now on policy, because these people in Iraq, the women, the girls, all of them, the families, the men, everybody who are survived this, what happened, are living in camps for the most part, in northern Iraq, in Kurdistan. For 3 years, they've been living as internally displaced persons, and there are many of them that have also gone to neighboring countries, Jordan or Lebanon or Turkey. And some of them, most of them, long to go back to their villages, and we're now facing a new phase of that genocide, and that is, will they be able to return to their villages and rebuild their lives now that it's been liberated by the military from ISIS? And it's not at all a certainty that they will. There's limited resources, there's limited aid, reconstruction aid, and there are minorities that are often marginalized in this part of the world, and particularly in Iraq. And so this is a big concern at this point, and the designation of genocide is very important, because it's a rationale of why they should not be ignored, as they have, I must say, for the last 3 years by the UN aid system. They have not been able to access the UN refugee camps or displaced persons camps, because it's too dangerous for them. The persecution follows them inside the camps. They have been dependent on churches that they found when they fleeing ISIS in the summer of 14. They found the churches, went to the churches, asked for help. Those priests and bishops and pastors had no idea that they were going to be wake up and find 100,000 plus refugees on their doorstep. And for the last 3 years, they've gone around the world knocking on doors, trying to find the money to feed them for the last 3 years, feed and house and clothe them, because ISIS took everything that they owned, including their livelihoods. So these people, even though they're Iraqi citizens, these Christians and Yazidis, even though they're Iraqi citizens, even though they were still in Iraq, in Kurdistan, they were not given resettlement rights, and they lived as refugees, essentially, dependent, wholly dependent on the churches and private aid, because the UN system failed them, did not give them the aid that they needed. And most of the U.S. aid, $1.3 billion in humanitarian aid that was given to Iraq since 2014, since ISIS, precious little of that has gone to the churches who are caring for this population, this large population, about 100,000 Christians, the remaining Christian community of Iraq, most of them, most of the remaining community of Christians of Iraq. It's not, given that history that has happened over the last 3 years of marginalizing these minorities, it's not a given that they will be given the aid to rebuild. They will not get a piece of the reconstruction pie, which is a small pie to begin with. And it's, Mosul alone has been estimated to going to cost $1 billion in aid to reconstruct Mosul. No, there are no Christians living in Mosul at that time, hardly any, because it was inhospitable to them. There was so much persecution going on then before ISIS. So will there be any money left over is the big question for the rebuilding Christian villages and towns on the Nineveh Plain. Will there be, or the Yazidis? I mean, the Yazidi area has been liberated for almost 2 years, and they have not been able to rebuild because they have not received reconstruction aid. This is enormous issue we're hoping to bring to the fore, that is we, the advocates for these minorities and people who are against genocide, to use the genocide label as leverage for getting them some attention and making sure they don't fall through the cracks, that they also are included in the rebuilding effort and in protection, because they will need protection and they don't have militias of their own.
Thank you, Nina. Certainly the statement by the Secretary of State is a step in the right direction, but would you speak a little bit more on, you explain how current policies and agreements are failing to address the immediate needs of these folks and not reaching a lot of these displaced peoples that need that aid.
There is House Resolution 390 that Congressman Chris Smith has introduced that has passed the House already. It's in the Senate, but it's stalled there. And that is very important for directing aid to the genocide-targeted minorities. There was already that language in the continuing resolution of the Spending Act. There was a provision in that that expires at the end of September. No aid has reached these, very little aid has reached these Christians. So the same policies that have been in effect all along that have sidelined them are still in effect. And that aid needs to be redirected. There is emergency provisions that allow that from USAID, for example. But there has to be a decision made to do that by the executive, and that has not happened. So, yes, Secretary Tillerson's statement yesterday was extremely important, because it's the clear direction that the United States would protect these minorities suffering persecution and genocide, and the U.S. would preserve their cultural heritage, which is at stake right now. Before 2003, there was an estimated 1.4 million Christians in Iraq. But by the time ISIS showed up, there were only about 450,000 left, so that's like a two-third decline. And now there's estimated, after ISIS, only about 200,000, so half that. And so 80% of the Christian community has now left Iraq and or been killed. The Mandean community, 90% have been stamped out before ISIS. So there is a real concern that the Middle East will not only, as the cradle of Christianity, be Christian free, but that pluralism, religious pluralism, is at stake. And these communities have been the bridge to the West, have been a moderating force, believe in citizenship and human rights and so forth. And it's going to be a problem for us as well, a national security problem, if there is constant instability because of the inability to tolerate others with others' beliefs. So this is extremely important that these legislative acts be passed and implemented, that there be transparency in what the projects are going to be, and that there be a project for reconstruction, because the U.S. is involved not in building homes. That is something that's been taken over entirely by almost entirely by the private sector. The Knights of Columbus, Aid to the Church in Need, have come forward with pledges and monies and campaigns to rebuild the destroyed homes, about 12,000 of them, for the Christians. Others have come forward with money for the Yazidis, but the big infrastructure projects like water, sewage, electricity, that's what the United States and the international community is needed for, and that the villages, because it's a very sectarian country. People live with their own religious communities. They tend to live with their own religious communities for self-protection, and that applies to Sunnis and Shiites as well, and as Christians and Yazidis. And it's really very incumbent on those of us who oppose genocide to see this through, to make sure that those villages of these minorities, the Christians and the Yazidis, also get hooked up to the grid, also get water, because otherwise they will not be able to return.
Thank you, Nina, for highlighting the policy solutions that need to take effect to address this genocide. Now, Ron, could we turn to you and have you discuss some of the legal solutions? You mentioned that part of that was in your chapter in the book.
Right. Well, you know, if once we determine, once we are able to label what's taking place a genocide, that does open up abilities for certain benefits to be given to the victims, but also in terms of prosecution, that gives us jurisdiction over the crime within the International Criminal Court. It also opens up other international law issues where again, if the perpetrators are captured, you have the ability to prosecute them. That's an awful big if, though. So much of what we end up ultimately depending upon is really a matter of do we have a military or a police ability to bring the perpetrators under control. No one likes to talk about the necessity sometimes of taking actions like that, but you know, you have to kind of catch the bad guys before you can try the bad guys. And that is one thing that I think we hit time and time again as we look at our different approaches that can be taken place there. So you're engaged in that front. You're engaged in an intellectual front as well. I mean, trying to engage people from a historical way, from a diplomatic way. We've got a great chapter on the Holy See's diplomatic response to the crisis in Syria. I do think that the papacy, the Pope, is a world leader who is able sometimes to speak on matters that certainly American domestic leaders feel unable to address. A lot of times our separation of church and state, I think, makes people very uncomfortable addressing different interpretations of religion. The Pope, and Pope Benedict and Pope Francis both have made statements that I think are very important, influential, that cause people to think. We tend to, and perhaps I do this sometimes incorrectly, draw a line between sort of Christian West and Middle East Islam, when you know, Muslims are quite often victims as well of crimes that are taking place, and it's not a matter of, for instance, all Muslims or all of Islam trying to committing these horrific acts. There are lots of folks who've been victimized by this as well, who are deemed to be not sufficiently pure and true to Islam for ISIS and other bad actors in the Middle East. Can we engage those people as well at a level that can create change from within? And I think when you read about what has been taking place in the chapter on the Holy See's diplomacy, in the chapter on the theory of religious freedom and how religious freedom deals with these matters, what it means, and even understanding Sharia law. Jeffrey Strickland wrote a chapter on the Islamic State and the moving past the phobia and matters of Islamic law and addressing those things intellectually. I believe we have an opportunity to make some advances along those lines. Of course, the legal machinery is there, and we're trying to prepare it and have it ready to go in place when the time becomes ripe for that. But we, I think we need these other engagements as well. And that's what I think the different chapters that this book brings forth complement one another so well.
Thank you, Ron. We'll go ahead and move now to audience Q&A. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, please enter the star key and then the pound key on your telephone. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Remember, to ask a question to our experts, please enter the star key and then the pound key on your telephone. While we wait for an audience question, would either of you like to comment on a chapter in the book that hasn't already been addressed in this conversation so far?
Well, Wesley, could I just comment on something that I said?
Of course.
May have been too hard on the UN. I don't think so, but I will say in its defense that there has been some very good reporting done. And in Jane Adolph's chapter on Nigeria, she mentions this, that the UN Secretary General's Special Representative on Sexual Violence and Conflict had, you know, early on started writing about this and documenting it. And similar things have happened in northern Iraq as well. In fact, that same representative has been just exemplary. And she's a Muslim woman. She was very adamant that, yes, this was slavery, sexual slavery. It wasn't voluntary, you know, going off as a jihadi bride. And that's very important. That documentation is starting to be collected, may not be admissible in the court ultimately, but it's important to flag this. The problem is that it has occurred with impunity. The hostage taking and ransom and the kidnapping has been taking place in these places with impunity, including in Nigeria now, and under the president happens to be Muslim now. Before it was Christian president. And it didn't matter. It was these attacks on entire villages, 10,000 or more, tens of thousands of people killed by Boko Haram, which is a terror group, Islamist terror group in affiliation with ISIS now. They've sworn allegiance, or a part of them has. There just doesn't seem to be a real determination to either eradicate it or to give relief to those who've suffered from it. And it's a terrible problem because those who are being kidnapped, the girls, are very young, in their teens. And there's a fear that they will have been indoctrinated after all this time now, 3 years. And the same fear is true of the children taken by ISIS in northern Iraq. What becomes of these people? And this, again, is a distinction of a distinct problem faced with the treatment of women and children under genocide, particularly these children now indoctrinated into a radical terror by ISIS, by Boko Haram. Are they the enemy or are they a victim at this point? And it's not a joke in Nigeria. These young girls have been blowing up as suicide bombers in marketplaces, bus stations, killing innocent people, both Muslim and Christian. And in Iraq, there has also been starting to see some suicide bombers who are women. In fact, some women carrying babies. There's Yazidi children who have been brainwashed into being jihadists and have suicide belts and execute other prisoners. So it's a problem of I guess, a political will to pursue it legally as well, to give a legal solution. Also, you know, they have accepted on the international level in Nigeria and in Iraq some training, some military training, some planning, but the implementation is very poor, especially in Nigeria now, but also in Iraq, there's a big hole there.
Thank you, Nina. We have two questions in the queue. Let's move to our first audience question. Again, if you'd like to ask a question, enter the star key and then the pound key on your telephone.
Hi, Nina and Ron. It's great to hear you guys and listen to you. And so I thank you for being with this teleforum today. This question kind of plays off of what Nina was just talking about with the problem of the political will to pursue some of these legal remedies. So my question is, given that Iraq has shown at least some willingness, if not the ability, to go after members of ISIS legally, you know, sometimes without any sense of due process. I think there was just a PBS NewsHour piece on some of these extrajudicial killings. What would the plausibility be of some sort of hybrid international court along the lines of, say, the special court for Sierra Leone?
Well, I'm going to let Ron answer that, but I want to also point out that these perpetrators were also, including some of the leaders, were from the West. And so there's British, there's French, there's German, there's Russian. So it's not just the government of Iraq that may be at fault here or responsible, have responsibility. In fact, the in Sweden and some of the Scandinavian countries as well, and in some of those places, like in Scandinavia, not only is there no trial and legal attempt to promote justice here, but there is a policy in place to rehabilitate and assimilate, to have them assimilated back in society, with even giving them jobs and helping them along the way. And, you know, I think, Ron, you addressed this actually in your chapter about how, for the sake of peace, sometimes it might not be the best interest to pursue these things legally. But so I'm going to let Ron talk about this.
Yeah, well, thanks, Nina. You know, there are times when, you know, not prosecuting actually can lead to peace rather than prosecuting. That is something I talk about in the chapter. Again, the International Criminal Court was actually designed to take the place of these tribunals that have been set up around the world, in Sierra Leone, former Yugoslavia, Rwanda. So it really is an extension of that. So the idea would be that the International Criminal Court, if it functions properly, would obviate the need to set up special tribunals at different places. Now, it was thought that would be logistically less expensive and easier. I think they're finding it's highly problematic, because getting the witnesses together, protecting the witnesses when they're being persecuted, gathering the evidence is very dangerous. That it's not functioning quite like it was envisioned as it was being put together. But the International Criminal Court was exactly the idea of having a tribunal to address these matters. You know, you could, if we had a tribunal, you still would have to determine that there was the appropriate jurisdiction, that you could safely gather defendants together, that you could carry out justice. And you know, as you look at what's going on right now, you know, I don't think it's feasible to go in someplace and set up a tribunal and be assured that the folks who went in there you know, would be safe and protected. So you've kind of got to get a handle on what's going on you know, you've kind of got to slow down, stop the violence before you can rebuild justice. And that's been true throughout history around the world. You know, in the middle of the really tough conflicts, you don't have the courts functioning. Courts function after you've brought back a semblance of a normal society.
I have read that the French Special Operations has presented a list of French nationals who were members of ISIS in Mosul or in Iraq and gave that to the Iraqi armed forces basically as a hit list to eliminate them. They said, we don't want them back in our country. Brett McGurk, who is the U.S. Coordinator of the coalition, civilian coordinator, he has said something similar, and I don't know if the United States actually presented a list, but they were. There seems to be some kind of informal policy to eradicate ISIS militants and leadership rather than to take prisoners, frankly, at this point. It may be determined by ISIS because ISIS's whole modus vivendi has been to die, to fight to death, and they're continuing to do so in a small center of Mosul right now and in Iraq, and as well as Tal Afar and other places scattered around Iraq and Syria.
Thank you.
Again,
for your
I think it's been I think that it's this whole international law solution has to be rethought, and there should be some serious focus on what happened with ISIS, why it was allowed to march into these places. It had a record. It was already known what they were up to because they had been in Syria before Iraq and been going through Iraq and starting in Fallujah and up to the north, and allowing that to happen, allow it to unfold, allowing them to continue to wreak havoc on the Yazidis on August 3 and 4, 3 years ago, and then to go to the Christian areas. I mean, it's that was not prevented. There was nothing done to prevent that. The Iraqis' own military melted away. The Kurds did as well. And then to have no real plan for a serious legal gathering of evidence. And there's been some evidence collected, but, in the vein of taking satellite photographs of mass graves, but there hasn't been any serious attempt or systematic attempt to take evidence of these of this genocide against these various communities. And again, it's Shia Muslim Yazidis as well as Christians who have been identified as being victims of genocide, of ISIS genocide. So there needs to be a rethinking and a reevaluation of where this broke down.
Thank you, caller, for your question. Before we reach our next question, just want to mention that our next telephone conference call is Friday, August 18th at noon Eastern. It's going to be titled, Is There a Death Squad at the U.S. Patent Office? Examining the Patent Trial and Appeal Board, and it's hosted by our Regulatory Transparency Project. Please keep an eye out for future telephone calls. You can always visit our website for our schedule of these, as well as any previously recorded telephone calls as podcasts. Let's move to our next audience question.
Hello, it's Mary Maxwell in Alabama. Thank you for all that information about the religious genocide. There's a U.S. Congresswoman. She's from Hawaii. I don't know if you are aware of her, Tulsi Gabbard. She has introduced a bill into the House, along with maybe eight or so co-sponsors. And then Rand Paul in the Senate made an identical one for the Senate. And it is called the Stop Arming the Terrorists Act. And the gist of it is that the U.S. is providing the weaponry for ISIS. And at first you mentioned that a monastery was pulverized to white dust. Now, I have no idea what kind of weaponry is used for that, but I don't think these congresspersons would be composing a bill if they didn't have information. And the the lady congresswoman, she was in Iraq as U.S. military for a while. So do you have any comment on the sponsorship or the production of weapons for these people?
Well, I think that's part of the investigation that has to be done. I don't really have anything reliable. I know that when ISIS went into Mosul, Mosul, again, was already very radicalized and was welcomed, and that's where Saddam Hussein's former commanders were then living in 2014. And it was already very radicalized. And in fact, the Christians were the canary in the coal mine. They started to be kidnapped and held for ransom and sometimes killed and tortured terribly, killed even if the ransom was paid, years before ISIS showed up. And this was done by radical Muslims who posted on the internet that they wanted to purify Mosul. So when ISIS showed up in 2014, and it was in June that they attacked Mosul, there were huge weapon depots there for the Iraqi military forces. And when the Iraqi military melted away, when they abandoned their posts and put on shed their uniforms and fled and blended in with the civilians and fled the area, ISIS took their weapons. And these were weapons the United States had given them, the Iraqi military. So I think it's a complex situation. I'm not sure that that bill is going to go anywhere, given that I would be very skeptical if that were to go anywhere, because I'm not sure that the leadership would bring it to a vote. And I think it is more complex than the notion that just, you know, like a government like Qatar or Saudi Arabia were supplying the arms. I mean, there's been a lot of complicity, and there's some good books written about this, about various governments turning a blind eye, for example, when their nationals are supplying money, or when their nationals are leaving the country, or when jihadis are to fight as jihadis, or when international jihadis are flowing over the border of Turkey into Syria to allow that to occur, or to have the government of Syria buying oil from ISIS, which was a mainstay of its economy for the last 3 years or 4 years in Syria. So I think there's been a lot of sources. There's a lot of taxation and checkpoints set up by ISIS, a lot of taxing of Muslim people in Mosul by ISIS in Raqqa to collect money. There's and revenue. There's the selling of artifacts. That was a very big source of income, and there are a lot of complicity and governments in that trade of very valuable ancient artifacts that belong to the Christians or the Assyrian people or the Roman from the ancient Roman days, coming out of that region by ISIS and giving it revenue, so with which it then can purchase arms on the markets. So it's I would be surprised if that bill was to go anywhere, and for all those reasons, and I'm not sure it would solve the problem.
Yeah, you know, I kind of agree. I think it's going to have a hard time going anywhere. It's really, I think, designed to stop the funding of ISIS in terms of trying to bring down the regime in Syria. The supporters have compared it to the banning of support to the Contras during the 1980s. And the idea is try not to. There's a horrible situation in Syria where the regime is bad, but they're fighting ISIS. And so you know, what side do you pick in a situation like that?
Also, Ron, there was we were supporting and training some Syrian rebels, but I think we've withdrawn from that.
You know, that's right. You know, it's a horrific situation.
Well, Nina and Ron, I believe the audience would agree with me in saying you've done a tremendous job shining light on this issue. On behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank you both for the benefit of your valuable time and expertise today. We welcome all listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us today, and especially to our speakers for dedicating this hour. This call is now adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.